You're watching Network Radio. Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
You're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal, where I'm very pleased to have as my featured guest for the first hour, Nick Kohlerstrom, PhD and historian of science from the UK. Nick is a wonderful scholar. He's published a completely brilliant book on the Holocaust entitled Breaking the Spell. He's a contributor to all three Moon Rock books. And I suppose we didn't go to the moon either, with a chapter on Paul McCartney and another on the Holocaust. He's contributed to Nobody Died at Sandy Hook with a brilliant appendix about the children and their homes. And he's also contributed a fascinating appendix about Charlie Hebdo in the Boston book. And Nobody Died in Boston either. Nick, it's a real pleasure to have you back on the show.
Well, this is certainly a bit of a different story than we've done before, Jim. Galactic battle. Do you think we're up to it?
Yes. Well, you give us the theme, which has to do with Star Wars and how it relates to contemporary events, Nick. I think it was a terrific idea, and I'm just very, very pleased to have you here to discuss it.
Well, this new Force Awakens is now storming ahead as the greatest box office success, and it's even threatening to overtake Avatar. And let's see now, it's the only film to sell 100 million in a single day of tickets, and it crossed the 1 billion mark of revenue on the 12th day of general release. So it's been a massive worldwide success. And I've got to confess, Jim, I went and saw it, which is what got me going, and I found it quite a toxic experience. I found all my dreams and imaginations of space were polluted by this, and I felt it rather trashed the very careful narrative that George Lucas had built up of Star Wars. For example, they blew up I felt a committee had put this story together for these huge sums involved. You know, Disney bought it for $4 billion off Lucasfilms. They spent $4 billion on the franchise of Star Wars. As if they said, oh, well, listen, last time we blew up the Death Star, that was quite a success. Why don't we do it again? So they built another Death Star and blew it up again. And then what was the highlight of the last Star Wars? Oh, yeah, it was Darth Vader turning out to be the father of Luke Skywalker. Well, let's see. Why don't we have the new Darth Vader as the son of Han Solo? Yeah, let's do that. I mean, it didn't make any sense. The new guy with a black helmet, you know, but why should he be the son of Han Solo? And why can't he just take the helmet off whenever he feels like it? And so I was quite disturbed by seeing this new film, Jim. And after that, I went back to the first three, the original trilogy of Star Wars, episodes 1, 2, and 3, which were made last. This is the paradox. And I couldn't realize how good they were. I think they're really brilliant. A master at the height of his powers making these three, this sequence, which starts off this massive epic from California, from his Skywalker Ranch in California, in Lucas Valley. He's woven these wonderful dreams from, as a kid, he used to read Marvel comics and, you know, that sort of thing. Flash Gordon, that sort of inspired him. And he's made this great masterpiece. I think it's a great masterpiece. The purpose of this chat we're having now, Jim, is to help people to enjoy the first three, because I think nearly everybody doesn't understand what they're about.
I think that's a wonderful idea, Nick. I, of course, have also seen the latest installment, and it's clearly done with a minimum of effort. It's recycling old themes. There's nothing original to be found there. It was merely done to make a lot of money.
Lucas said he sold it to the slave traders. Can you believe it? He was asked, why on earth did you want to sell on your franchise? In an interview, he said, I just sold it to the slave traders. and that's the way he's got rid of his great masterpiece.
Well, in a way, it was George Lucas going over to the dark side himself.
Anyway, my thing is, the first three have got a deeply relevant political message. And I think there's virtually nothing on the web about it. And there is, I don't think people get what it is. And George Lucas isn't terribly forthcoming. I'll tell you what I think most he said. He said, talking about his character Palpatine, the central character, it's not the first time a politician has created a war just to stay in office. Now, that sort of is relevant, but it's not the half of it. There's far more than that to it. And what I think we should start off by pondering is that these three films were made in 1998, 2000, and 2003. Okay? So the last of these was the only one to be made after 9/11. All three were made around 9/11. And they're about this new darkness coming into our world, which bewilders everyone. In the Star Wars film, the Jedi don't believe it for a long time. They don't think it can be happening. Nobody thinks it can be happening. It's about the coming of total absolute power, which Palpatine proclaims, the first galactic empire, which trashes the Senate, the Republic. It starts off with a Senate, a Republic, which is democracy, you know, and the Jedi, they're the good guys. Jedi are supposed to be defending democracy, and this gradually moves over into total absolute power by something very occult and hidden, which is very puzzling. People are wondering what's making it all happen. And the third of these movies, the one made after 9/11, has this great sort of darkness and extinction of hope. The Jedi all get wiped out, and Darth Vader is created,
laying the foundation for episodes 4, 5, and 6, which, of course, were the first broadcasts, the first actually made. You're talking about the prequel going back to before the introduction of Luke Skywalker, Princess Leia, Han Solo.
Right. Before any of those arrive, yeah. And there's a tendency not to be interested in the prequel, especially because there are huge battles going on. You can't figure out who's fighting who or what the point of it all is. If you follow it, we inevitably do so knowing retrospectively, knowing in advance that this terrific Darth Vader character is going to appear. By the way, there's a lot of a connection of Joseph Campbell, the great American mythologist, with George Lucas. George Lucas much admired him, and they met and they became very close friends. I don't know how much he influenced him, but the stories that that Lucas sought out archetypal stories like Darth Vader being the Dark Father, okay? The Dark Father, who's very remote, scary and remote, that American generation grew up with the fathers off in Vietnam, so the father was very remote and absent. Do you think that makes any sense, Jim?
Yeah, good. Nick, we can begin with your slides. You have slides that I know are not in a specific order, but, meaning that if you had one in mind, I may not have realized it when I put them together, but we can begin in the beginning with the first slide if you want to start there, Nick.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Let's move through a few. Here is the Clone Wars. The second episode is about the Clone Wars. If I could just characterize the first three of these prequels. The first one has a stupendous race, a pod race on the little the little planet Tatooine, a sandy, impoverished planet, and very exciting, in which the young Anakin, a very plucky young kid, manages to win the race. That's a very thrilling episode. The second has a wonderful love affair between Anakin as he's grown up into a powerful Jedi, and he falls in love with the senator Almeida. And then the third has the drama of Anakin going over to the dark side. Okay, the moral struggle: which side does he want to adhere to? So perhaps we start off looking at some of these slides. Yeah. Well, are we on the first one now?
Yes. You should be able to see it, Nick.
Okay. Well, this looks like the Clone Wars. These are the clones. They're all bred. Terrific new army. And nobody's quite sure who ordered them or who they're bred for. But they're actually for the Republic. They're sort of there to fight the Republic. So they are live human beings cloned to be genetically programmed to be obedient. Okay. Right. Now let's move on to modern relevance of our story. What happened on 9/11? I suggest that there's something deeply mysterious about 9/11. Ultimately, none of us really know who did it, who exactly did it. And none of us really know what happened to the towers. How come they turned into dust? So many 100,000 tons turned into dust in 10 seconds. So there is a mystery there. Let's remind ourselves. And this is the defining event of the new millennium. So here are two guilty as hell culprits we're looking at here. And then Dick Cheney, next one. Dick Cheney actually says about going over to the dark side. We have to work through sort of the dark side, if you will. Yeah. Okay. Then, next one. So this became a sort of theme from when the Star Wars started using it. What does it mean, going over to the dark side?
Tragic. Next slide.
Yeah. Okay.
Perhaps we can this is an excellent theme of Jane Meyer, the inside story of how the war on terror turned into a war on American ideals. I think that's perfectly capturing what transformed in historically in relation to 9/11.
Yeah. Do you recommend this book, Jim? I haven't read it all.
Well, I haven't read it either, but thematically, it looks to me to be exactly on the target.
Yeah, I think hearing a woman's voice would be something. Must say that the first three, the first maid of the Star Wars, the famous ones, the earlier ones, established a dualistic philosophy, which we call Manichaean. Manichaean is the idea of a cosmic battle between light and darkness. And this was formulated in fairly absolute terms between the good guys and the bad guys. And we get it formulated as the Jedi versus the Sith. Now.
Well, we have one more slide first, Nick, if you don't know.
Which
is of a very dark figure in 9/11, Larry Silverstein.
Yeah, here he is.
He had two white elephants on his hands. He took possession of the Twin Towers, the World Trade Center, just 6 weeks before 9/11, fired the security firm that had been looking after the complex from its inception, from its opening in 1970, obtained a new insurance policy with anti-terrorist clause, and then claiming two planes had been involved in two attacks. Double indemnity, pocketing over $4.5 billion on a $114 million investment. When the buildings were loaded with asbestos, they were under a directive from the Port Authority that it had to be removed. It would have been prohibitively expensive to put scaffolding around 110-story buildings, and you couldn't do it by conventional demolition without releasing the asbestos particles and other biohazards into the environment. Wasn't it convenient that there just happened to be a terrorist attack on these two white elephants that enabled Larry Silverstein to pocket a bundle.
Yeah, and Lucky Larry just got a note telling him not to go up to his usual breakfast cafe at the top of the North Tower.
Sheriff's coincidence. He had a dermatological appointment, Nick. Amazing. And his daughter, who also worked there, also did not show up. Really fascinating.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Let's go to the next slide, Sheriff 7.
If we carry on with our theme, this is... I'd like to give a couple of quotes now about the transition whereby democracy gets eclipsed. The war on terror has been used to destroy our democratic heritage and principles, and instead implement an oligarchy in which rather secret rulers hold power and can apparently do what they like. This is the most mysterious thing about what gets called the New World Order or the Illuminati, that we're not quite sure who's in control, but they seem very much in control, don't they? Seems a very centralized control.
Yes.
Okay. Now, let's focus on this character, Senator Palpatine. He appears in the first as a benevolent senator from this planet Naboo. In the first episode, there's a crisis going on this planet Naboo that it's been it's under quarantine, it's been attacked, and the Trade Federation, something to do with taxation, whatever, the Trade Federation has quarantined the planet, and it's in grave peril, and they are asking the Senate for permission to send an army. Okay, and the Emperor Palpatine says to the Princess Almeida, look, they're just vacillating around. The Senate are just going to vacillate around. They won't do anything. The bureaucrats are in control. And we need some more absolute decision, more absolute autocracy to be able to make things happen. Okay. And she moves a vote of no confidence in the chief manager of the Republic, and they elect Palpatine, surprise, surprise. He then gets elected. Okay. Now, here's the dark secret, what I think is the secret of the first episode of Star Wars that most people don't get, that there's a Dark Lord of the Sith who turns up and is actually masterminding this quarantining of the planet and of the attack on it, and the whole disturbance. He's a sort of phantom figure. And the first episode is called The Phantom Menace, right? And it's a sort of phantom image you see, and it's actually a projection of Palpatine himself. Unknown to the Jedi, he is a top Sith Lord, okay? He's a very sinister figure that even the Jedi themselves could be in his presence and not realize that he is the cause of all the trouble. And he's got this amazing power to project a double right over, long way away, to this planet Naboo that's in quarantine. And he can then give instructions, and they are following his instructions in what they do. And he produces another Sith, what's called Darth Maul or something, who's a Turek fighter, and he is solid and totally solid, and he fights with the Jedi. So the story here is that a senator is deliberately precipitating what you might call false flag terror, okay? He's deliberately precipitating false flag terror in order to gain absolute power. And he's successful in doing that, okay? He gets absolute power without anyone realizing. The Jedi know that the Sith are their nemesis and opposite, okay? The Jedi understand that they are, I don't know, the good guys, or they're avoiding what's called the dark side. And the Sith have gone over to the dark side, and they therefore have much greater power. Okay? Does that make any sense?
Yeah, go right ahead. Yes, Nick. Yeah. Yes.
Okay. So a bit like talking about a black magician or whatever, the Sith had this terrific power, and as Anakin grows up, he's put through this terrific dilemma because he's got a lot of anger within himself, anger and terrific ambition and pride, and knows he's right, and he sort of is right, okay? And so the drama of the first three episodes is Anakin, with his terrific ability and intelligence and power, that the Jedi say, no, look, we don't have power. We are just defenders of the Senate. We're defenders of the Republic. We're not here to fight a war, and we don't take power. We don't have power. And young Anakin wants power. Okay, let me just... Senator Palpatine, I'm being granted this absolute despotism, right? Analogy here you might want to make, Jim, is the end of the old Roman Republic as it turned into a total despotism with the Caesars. You know, they seized absolute power, and the old voting of the Senate and Republic came to an end. A bit of an analogy. And Palpatine says, in order to ensure, he says, sorry, it's with great reluctance that I've agreed to this calling. I love democracy. I love the Republic. Once this crisis has abated, I will lay down the powers you have given me. Okay? Well, of course, he never will. You know, he's got exactly what he wants. And another good quote from him, he pronounces to the Senate, in order to ensure our security and continuing stability, the Republic will be reorganized into the First Galactic Republic. For a safe and secure, empire, First Galactic Empire, for a safe and secure society. So he's assuming total control through the galaxy, and so that is, as it were, at the core of the story. And when Darth Vader appears later on, he is having this total control that his mentor, Palpatine, kind of taught him to have. So that is the struggle that George Lucas has blueprinted, and.
Do you want to illustrate with some of these slides, like number 8 now? Just to explain how it fits, how these fit in. This is Senator.
This is the beautiful Senator Almeida that Anakin falls in love with, and she bears his child. She eventually is devastated when she realizes Anakin is getting power crazed and going over the dark side, and he sort of threatens her, and eventually, after Anakin, right at the end, through a dramatic battle, Obi-Wan Kenobi beats Anakin, just about beats him after a terrific lightsaber battle. So the only hope in the closing scenes of the third episode is that Almeida has a couple of kids. She dies giving birth.
A number of the slides, like number 9, seem to me to capture more of the spirit of the themes than the next several you have here.
Right. Well, hang on. If I just go back to Senator Almeida. Talking about this wonderful love affair, wonderful interplanetary love affair that George Lucas has given us in part 2. And it's been like Romeo and Juliet in the sense that it's forbidden. It's forbidden love, okay? Because as a Jedi, Anakin has to renounce marriage, love, romance, and sex, okay?
Is this like being a monk, Nick?
Yeah, it is. It's totally being a monk. Being a Jedi is totally like being a monk. And so he, as it were, has it both ways. He manages to secretly marry Senator Almeida, and then later on, he becomes the top.
Isn't that disturbing all by itself that he should violate his oath or commitments as a Jedi?
Well, can you blame him with a lady as beautiful as this? You know, you see, the Jedi Council, with the wise Yoda on it, never agreed to him being trained as a Jedi. They always say, look, we sense is that there's a prophecy that one is going to come who's going to bring balance to the Force. And this fellow who trains Obi-Wan Kenobi, his name is Qui-Gon, he's the Jedi in the first, main Jedi in the first two episodes. He picks out this Anakin, this brilliantly talented young kid, and he senses that he's got this terrific, you know, the Force is strong in him, all that mystic stuff. I sense that the Force is strong in him. So he senses that Anakin has got this very strong Force, and he wants to train him, but the Jedi Council always refuses. It says, no, there's too much disturbance there. He's too angry and headstrong and so on. So they're very divided about whether they want him to be a Jedi, right? And he is quite headstrong. And so he then falls in love with Senator Almeida. Okay, should we move on to the next one, Jim?
Yeah, you have several about episode 3.
Yeah, okay, this is Anakin, brilliant actor. Sorry, I don't know the name of him, but he shows that the terrific moody passion that as he goes through life, wondering which side he's supposed to be on.
The next slide may show some of that tension.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, this is a composite for the whole film.
Revenge of the Sith.
Of the Sith. Yeah. So there are only two Sith, curiously enough, but they're enormously powerful, and they can do so much because the Jedi doesn't recognize they're there. So this is a story of battle where all the combat, you wonder, what's the point of all this? One side breeds a terrific clone army, and the other side breeds a terrific drone army. Drones are robots, okay? And so you're wondering what the point of all this is, and in a sense, it's all engineered by Palpatine so that he can get the absolute power that he wants. And I'm suggesting this is terribly relevant to the world we live in. I think if kids could be given this message that rulers create wars because they want the power. It's the drug, the intoxication of having the war for these very evil characters. And it stops you asking questions when a war is going on. They can get away with everything. So my feeling is that if we could understand these first three episodes, this is a moral story for our time that George Lucas has given us of wars being generated in a secret occult manner, in a hidden, very hidden way, just so that this hidden power, the Sith, can get absolute control of the galaxy.
Huh. Number 13. 11. Slide 11. Right, yeah.
Yeah, this is another one. You see the moody young Anakin in the middle. On one side there's Obi-Wan Kenobi, and the other there's the Senator Almeida. I think she's Senator. Right. Okay.
Slide 12 seems to me to capture the theme.
Right. Yeah. Well, this is the horrific world we live in. The unreality of horrible, apparently pointless wars. But behind them, there is the purpose of world domination, isn't there? I think the kids could be educated, perhaps use this, the Star Wars. I don't know about you, Jim. I feel there are two supreme movies, science fiction movies, made just before 9/11, which are kind of auguries of what happened, right? One of them is The Matrix, the famous sci-fi Matrix, about the kind of unreal world we're going into, and in which we're threatened with sort of losing our humanity. And the other is this, these three episodes of Star Wars that I think these really have got a message for us. Yeah.
I think you're onto something, Nick. Number 13.
Huh. Okay. Well, here it is. Emperor Palpatine, he's gradually working on Anakin, right? The young Anakin. The young Anakin is totally torn with the Jedi Council asking him to spy on Palpatine. And Palpatine saying, you know, the Jedi don't appreciate you, do they? They don't realize how good you are. They don't really trust you, do they? And Palpatine saying, well, no, they don't. They don't seem to, no. So Palpatine is wooing the young Anakin to come over, as it were, to the dark side. So Palpatine is secretly the dark Sith Lord. He may not look very like it there, but that is the story. He's wanting this terrific galactic control, and this nice-looking young man will eventually mature through a terrifying metamorphosis in part three. He will mature into Darth Vader.
Here on slide 14, you have a meeting of the council.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, this is wonderfully imagined by George Lucas, that the different, this is in the Jedi Temple on the central planet of Coruscant. That's the capital planet of the Galactic Republic. And it's all mainly a huge city throughout the whole. You see the planes flying over all the time. And here is the very impressive Jedi Council. And you see Yoda in the middle here with the big ears. And they're interviewing, or they're chatting to the young Anakin. So this is the first film when he's just a little kid, and he's being asked how he feels. And they're basically telling the Jedi, look, we appreciate you want to train him, but he's actually too old to start a Jedi training. But they insist, and he will be accepted anyhow. So there's the story of the prophecy is being fulfilled. The Jedi have got a prophecy. So this is a bit like a kind of religious message, isn't it? A religious theme. A lot of people these days, if they're asked on forums, what is your religion? You know, they put down Jedi. George Lucas has got his story across in a way that we feel a lot of sympathy with today. We can't believe in you can't easily believe in a transcendent God, but there is, we like the idea of some sort of force and destiny working through these people, the Jedi, who are sort of monks, and helping to guide the galaxy. Now, say, Jim, I feel that George Lucas, if you look at all the different worlds that appear in this Star Wars epic, I think he's optimistic. I think most of the worlds he conjures up are fun. They look, it's fun, exciting places to be at. And the different characters, all sorts of colourful characters he envisages. So I would say his vision of the whole universe that he gives us is one of optimism.
That's most interesting. The next slide, 15, shows a lot of themes here.
Yeah.
Players.
Yeah, well, this shows the theme of duality, which George Lucas brings in, between the light and the dark side, okay? And Anakin has this terrific decision that the Sith, you know, grows a power if he goes over to the dark side. And in particular, he's terrified, he's had a premonition that his true love, this Amidala, is going to die at childbirth. He's been given that premonition. And the Palpatine of the Sith said, you know, there are Sith who can rescue people from death. And he'd be given that illusory hope. So he's wondering which side to be on. Okay, that's very much the drama that George Lucas has conjured up here.
I love your next slide, number 16.
All right. Who's this lady, Jim?
Liz Cheney.
Liz Cheney, all right. Yeah, well, right. What can you say, right?
Number 17.
Okay, this is the moody Anakin, brilliant actor, and Ewan McGregor as the young Obi-Wan Kenobi. Again, I think they'll make a wonderful duo on some fiery planet of lava. I think here, this is some final combat but between them. Perhaps I could add here the idea of what George Lucas has brought out with the Jedi Knights, Jim. It reminds me of the medieval legends of knightly combat. You know, the knights in armor in medieval times. And they would have fights. And the fight wasn't just how tough you were, but it ascertained your virtue. The idea that your power in combat is expressive of some sort of virtue that you've got. The great knight of, I don't know, Galahad or Parsifal or something, could win in knightly combat, and this showed that he had virtue, right? And I'm reminded here that the Latin word virtus, virtue, means strength, okay? So we've got the same word, virtue and strength. And that's sort of what George Lucas brings out in the power of the Jedi in combat. Who wins in a fight is to do with mastery of the force. It's not just that you're quick or you're tough, or you've got a better lightsaber. It's some sort of idea of having a mastery of the force, that you have power.
And of course, having power and exercising it with a sense of justice and propriety is very different from having power and exercising it for the sake of domination and control.
Yeah, totally right. So it's given us a really moral universe in which Yoda says things like, fear is the path to the dark side, fear leads to anger, anger leads to hate, hate leads to suffering. So he's constantly constantly warning not to go over to the danger of not controlling your thoughts. And he says, if once you start down the dark path, forever will it dominate your destiny, consume you it will.
Slide number 18 exemplifies a fairly terrifying image.
Yeah, now this is a genuine Sith Lord, right? A Sith Lord who appears, and he's somehow the double. This Palpatine projects this phantom image, right? Who's in control of this the quarantine of the planet. And he has this companion, Sith Lord, who's very, very powerful. And he kills the top Jedi, Qui-Gon. And then he finally gets killed by Obi-Wan Kenobi. So very exciting fights go on here. He doesn't say a lot, really. He's just a warrior who goes out to try and challenge them, and then eventually he gets done in. Yeah.
Slide 19 is a lighter moment.
Huh? Oh yeah, right. Okay, so here are three of the top actors in the first one, right? With the trusty machine, R2-D2, behind them. And I think the little child Anakin is a brilliant actor. He's, how long would we say he was? About 9 years old or something?
Yes, I would say.
Yeah. Okay. So just for the record, he sort of gets a crush on Padme, who he meets when they come crashing down on this impoverished planet where he lives. And she's there with the princess, Padme, and he gets a crush on her then when he's 9 years old. And then 10 years later in part two, when he's grown up, he then falls in love with her and then they get together.
Next slide, number 20, ties together several of these themes.
Right. Yeah, we see the queen worried about her, what's happening to our world, and that is the Qui-Gon, so I don't know his name, but a top Jedi, very fine actor. And behind him, the called Darth Maul, Dark Lord of the Sith, right?
Yes, absolutely. 21 is one of the introductions to an episode here, the Attack of the Clones.
Yeah, that was that the second one?
Yeah. Episode two, yeah.
Yeah, well, it gets quite hard to follow, but on the mysterious planet Kamino, the Jedi goes out there and discovers a vast clone breeding program. And nobody's quite clear who's ordered them, but this fellow Count Dooku, who was a Jedi Knight, and he's turned over to the dark side, and he's working for Senator Palpatine. So that is then leading the disruption. But hang on, I might have got that wrong.
No, I think you got the 23.
The clones are fighting on behalf of the Republic, because initially the clones actually come and rescue the Jedi upon one point when they're in trouble. And I think the Count Dooku has a whole army of drones that are destructed. And they are quarantining this planet. It's quite interesting. There's virtually no fights between ordinary human beings in this Star Wars saga. It's all clones, robots, and Jedis. Yeah.
Slide 22.
Okay.
This is the very first episode.
Yeah. May I say, I recommend getting it in Blu-ray. I've been watching it in Blu-ray, and it's a brilliant, entertaining experience.
Do you mean in 3D?
It's not 3D. No, I haven't seen it in 3D.
It is in Blu-ray, but it is also in 3D.
Oh, is it?
Yeah.
All right. Is it any good in 3D?
Well, you know, you get all the effects of the spatial dimensions. These are quite sensational in 3D, these films.
Yeah.
Just like they have the new Spider-Man in 3D, too. And, of course, you know, when you're swinging through space, the effects are really quite overwhelming.
Well, certainly the new Star Wars is in 3D. But just special effects without a story is kind of a bit pointless in the end. But
yes, here's number 23. This is of episode 2, about what you've been speaking.
Yeah, this is a composite. You see in the middle, that's the projection of the Dark Lord Palpatine, who's kind of controlling everything, and nobody knows who he is. When a Jedi initially told that it's him, that they refuse to believe it. Because it's such a strange thing for them. So Lucas has given us quite a hidden message here in the first film.
And any resemblance between the Emperor and George H.W. Bush is purely coincidental.
Well, yes.
Slide number 24. Again, episode 2, The Attack of the Clones, the Love Affair.
Yeah, this is I mean it's beautifully done, and she produces the guy who grows up to be Luke Skywalker, and also Leia, Princess Leia. So her two kids have to be hidden away when she dies. The Jedi are nearly all wiped out, except for Obi-Wan Kenobi. And Obi-Wan Kenobi has to go off into hiding and wait for these kids to grow up, because that is the only hope for rescuing the galaxy, as it were. So the Galactic Empire comes to prevail. Palpatine gets Darth Vader, and Palpatine knows that he has some precognition. He can tell in advance that that Anakin is going to go over to the dark side and agree to become the new top Dark Lord. Okay, and there's this this Count Dooku who we saw referred to a minute ago, who was leading this separationist army and doing it all on behalf of the Emperor, and he then has a fight with Anakin, and when Palpatine is present, and now Palpatine tells Anakin to kill him. So Dooku is very bewildered, because he's been serving his master all the time, and now he says kill him. And it's as if there can be only one top Dark Lord at any given time. And so Anakin is going to become that. That's in part 3.
Here's your final slide, Nick, for you to expand upon at length.
Well, yeah. Well, I've quoted that already. It has got a moral message, hasn't it? A moral message, and the idea that you can develop some sort of inner power with mindfulness, a bit like it's quite like the Oriental idea of a master and a pupil, right? There's a lot of people calling each other master in these films. The Jedi pupil has a master and is trained by the master, and Yoda here is quite wise, and he has some ability. He sort of closes his eyes and meditates and sense things. His ability to sense things, sense what happens. So he's very much a key figure.
So Nick, we can just have a conversation here about the series, because independent of the slides now, because it seems to me you're suggesting in part that while we began with episodes 4, 5, and 6, and they have political themes, that the more important foundation for understanding the series as a totality was laid in episodes 1, 2, and 3, which were constructed around the time of 9/11, only 3 after the actual event. In order to appreciate the political dimensions of the Star Wars series, you have to come to grips with the hidden forces, the power of the dark side, and its parallels in the world of political community, especially in relation to the United States, 9/11, and the role of Dick Cheney and others in going over to the dark side, abandoning the principles upon which this country was founded, much more of a authoritarian government rather than democratic, and where we have been led into endless wars.
That's a very good summary. I certainly endorse that. And I feel that George Lucas, as it were, hasn't said, like many artists, he doesn't say a lot explaining what he's done. He just said, for example, I'm telling an old myth in a new way. I consciously set out to recreate myths, okay? Which he did, I think, brilliantly. But in a sense, it's not an old myth. But what happened with 9/11 is something new in our world, and none of us really understand it. And a whole lot of people don't want to understand it, okay? And I'm suggesting there's a generation of kids growing up who won't ever read a book, I'm sorry to say, or won't read a lot, but are much more visual in their approach. And they can tell you all the details of Star Wars, but won't read a book. And I'm hoping, Jim, this might be a way of getting through to them. I mean, what do you think about that?
Well, I think without indications of what's going on, that it's largely going to go over the heads of the public, Nick. I believe that the American people have lost their capacity for critical analysis. They've been exposed to too much television, too much propaganda, too much meaningless chatter from talking heads on television or simply promoting the government line on everything.
Well, let's put it this way, Jim. Supposing you were giving a 9/11 conference, or supposing you had an opportunity to talk to a school, might you want to start off with a few minutes of some one of these Star Wars themes that we've been looking at? Wouldn't that be sort of exclusive?
Well, I think you're opening a whole dimension here that has been implicit but requires explicit discussion, such as you're offering here today, Nick. So I'm very, very pleased at having this conversation with you.
Yeah, I mean, I enjoy doing workshops, you know, and for example, at my old college, Cambridge, I'm absolutely bewildered that there is no truth society and no place where students want to discuss the most important event of this millennium, namely 9/11, and the fact they don't. And people, so let's accept people have got a mental blockage. Somehow their curiosity and intellect is blocked on this, and we're not quite, it's hard to figure out why. I'm wondering if these Star Wars images could be used for the idea of going over to the dark side for the quest for absolute, total, global world control. I'm wondering if this could be used, especially in view of that sequence, the remarkable sequence that the first three are made just around the time of 9/11, And I think as a great creative artist, George Lucas would have been massively influenced by 9/11 without him quite wanting to verbalize it. You see what I mean?
Yes. Well, Hollywood, produces many pedestrian works. There's a new film featured at the Sundance Film Festival on Monday called Newtown that is simply parodying the official line of 20 children and 6 adults having been killed by Adam Lanza, which has been so repeatedly proven to be complete and utter rubbish.
Yeah.
They have the FEMA manual for the 2-day drill, where many were so confused about the dates that they put up donation sites already on the 13th.
Totally, yeah.
The recording of the date of death of Adam Lanza was again on the 13th, making his feat in shooting 20 children and 6 adults the following day all the more remarkable. How can anyone promote this rubbish, Nick? This has to be simply cooperating with the government in a mass propaganda campaign to promote gun control.
Yeah, it is. May I say, Jim, that I mentioned the film The Matrix earlier. The Matrix has people trapped in this unreal fabricated world. And one of the way the characters tell they're in The Matrix is when the time sequence goes wrong, okay? When things happen in a not quite in the right time sequence. And what you just mentioned about the tribute sites going up the day before it happened, that is an example of a time sequence going wrong, you know? So I'm suggesting that film can help people to grapple with it somehow. You know, there's always this mysterious saying that the Illuminati of the Empire have to say what they're going to do before they do it, or give you some indication in the media of what's going to happen.
Yeah, but of course there's so much out there. How can you tell that this is what it is that they're going to do rather than that, you know? You're going to have to go all kinds of alternative histories, and they're thereby informing you when you have no idea that that's what's going on. I think that's a very duplicitous, backhanded, and despicable attitude to adopt, that they've somehow warned you in advance, and therefore they've discharged a moral responsibility for committing grossly immoral acts.
Right, yeah. Okay. Well, let me just give a quote, which I think was in the third episode, which directly relates to what George Bush says. If you're not with me, then you're my enemy, said Anakin after he turned, echoing a sense. That's echoing what George Bush said. And then Obi-Wan, who was his previous master, replies, only a Sith deals in absolutes. So Anakin was feeling the sense of absolute power, making this outrageous statement, if you're not with me, then you're my enemy. And that rather echoes, that might have been copied from what George Bush said, mightn't it? Sounds a bit as if it was.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you're either with us or you're with the terrorists.
Yeah.
You know, so there weren't a prudent way of trying to figure out what actually happened here rather than beg the question that it's a simple black and white good versus evil proposition. I think you're completely correct about themes involved here, Nick, and that you're discussion of it is going to precipitate further consideration, deliberation, criticism. I think that's all to the good, and I'm therefore most appreciative of having you here today.
All right. So do you agree that supposing a way of getting through to young people or school education, a bit of this, especially the first three episodes of Star Wars, could be helpful?
Yes.
And also that what I'm hoping is this discussion, things we're going to do, will help people to enjoy that sequence more. I think it is a great American masterpiece from California. Wonderful dreams brewed in California, it's not. If you look at most accounts of what it's about, they don't bring out this side of it properly. So I'm hoping that this will enable listeners to enjoy viewing it.
I think you've done a great job and raised important issues and themes. I'm very pleased with this. Coincidentally, Chance has a 2 to 3 minute clip to play of stormtroopers talking about the Death Star as if it was 9/11.
All right. Go ahead.
Add that as a touch to, you know, emphasize the themes you've raised here. I can't thank you enough. This is Jim Fetzer thanking my special guest, Nick Kohlerstrom, who is, in addition, the leading expert on 9/11 and on the Boston bombing, 7/7 Boston bombing in the world today. Track down his book, Terror on the Tube, for being here. And all of you for watching, stand by for Chance's clip and for the new JFK show, which will follow.
I don't know. I just feel like we all have really great aim until the second we put on these helmets.
I concur.
Yeah.
You know, I don't want to be a downer, but you guys do know what tomorrow is.
What's tomorrow?
The anniversary of the Death Star.
The Death Star?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, my God. It's been a year already.
Yeah.
Man, such a huge thing. All it took was a couple X-Wings to take it down.
Yeah. You guys remember where you were when it happened?
Yeah, I remember I was in Coruscant training, waiting to hear some friends made it out. And, of course, they didn't because, well...
It blew up and evaporated.
Yeah, like a big, colorful firecracker. No one was getting out of there.
You guys know I was actually on my way to the Death Star that morning. Forgot to set my alarm. Got caught in space traffic. If it hadn't been for that space traffic,
I can't think about that. You're gonna drive yourself
crazy.
I'd be dead.
I guess I'd be dead.
You know, it's just so eerie. Hey, you look at that part of the galaxy where the Death Star used to be. And it's just nothing.
Yeah. Still waiting on that memorial. Right now, it's just
a little space garden.
Oh, the space garden. I hear they're going to build a new one, though. It's going to be almost as big.
Yeah, eight times as big.
Haven't we learned anything?
Look, I mean, if you don't rebuild, the Jedi's win.
Jedi's. I'll tell you something. They hate our way of life.
Now, just because someone believes in the Force doesn't mean they're going to go blow up a space station, all right?
Yeah, maybe. Listen, we have all of this technology, right? We can't find Luke Skywalker, one guy,
got a point.
Hiding out in a cave somewhere in Dagobah.
You know, honestly, I just think Palpatine knew all along. And he let it happen just to justify going to Hoth.
Here we go.
No, I'm serious. What? Darth Vader happens to be in a TIE fighter when the whole thing goes down, please. Come on.
All right.
Now,
here we go.
I read the engineering, okay? There was no way one X-Wing could have taken this thing out.
Okay.
No way. It had to be a controlled demolition.
Connor, nobody wants to hear this.
You're blind. You are blind, sir. You're blind.
Whatever.
You're all a bunch of drones.
Hey, keep your voice down.
Your drones, especially the drones.
Cool it.
Here, have a drink.
You guys want another round?
No, we're fine.
You want another round?
Yeah, you know what? Actually, you can keep coming. I think.
Come on.
That'd be great. To the Death Star.
Death Star.
Death Star.
Less than 3% of you people read books, because less than 15% of you read newspapers. Right now, there is a whole, an entire generation that never knew anything that didn't come out of this tube. This tube can make or break presidents, popes, prime ministers. Television is not the truth. Television is a circus, a carnival, a traveling troupe of acrobats, storytellers, dancers, singers, jugglers, sideshow freaks, lion tamers, and football players. We deal in illusions, man. None of it is true. But you people sit there day after day, night after night, all ages, colors, creeds.
Broadcasting live on network radio.
So turn off your television sets, turn them off now, turn them off and leave them off.
Now say, with moral certainty and considerable scientific authority, that the death of JFK was committed by a meticulously executed conspiracy which was obscured by an extensive cover-up. Murder in Dealey Plaza, edited by James Fetzer, goes to the heart of the JFK assassination. You'll read new and up-to-date information regarding the Secret Service, the Lincoln limousine, the medical evidence, the cover-up, altering the film,
Framing the Patsy, and The Silent Historians. Also, 16 smoking guns, each one crushing the government's lone assassin scenario. A world-class chronology of November 22, 1963. Chapters by David W. Mantic, Gary Aguilar, Vincent Palomara, Douglas Weldon, Jack White, Ira David Wood III, James H. Fetzer, Doug Horn, and a classic essay by Bertrand Russell. The complete story in the pages of one single book, edited by James H. Fetzer. Read it now. Read it again. You'll use it as a reference. Murder in Dealey Plaza. Available at Amazon.com and major bookstores around the world. It's murder.
This is Jim Fetzer, your host on The Real Deal.
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade.
It looks like one of those scenes of an old building being purposely dynamited and blown.
When we are successful,
I'm just a patsy.
And we will be.
We're ready to make to come to the microphone, so we'll listen up.
A new world order.
So my name's Robbie Parker.
It might have appeared that way, but from my close-up inspection, there's no evidence of a plane having crashed anywhere near the Pentagon.
Let us never tolerate outrageous conspiracy theories concerning the attacks of September the 11th.
President Kennedy died at 1 p.m.
Live from the Media Broadcasting Center.
Welcome to the new JFK show, number 89. Wow, we're rolling up on number 90, and I guess we'll hit 100 pretty soon. All right, everyone knows that's aware in the JFK community that when it comes to new JFK research, no one beats Larry Rivera, and no one beats our team of JFK researchers. We have Dr. Jim Fetzer, Don Fox, myself, and let's not forget Chance George. He's just as much a part of this team as anyone else. All right, so tonight we're going to bring you more information about the Z-Film operation. So by now, if whoever is disputing Z-Film, well, then you've got an op. So it's just time to change the channel and tune in to NBC and the new JFK show where the real truth is. So Larry's really loaded with both barrels, so we're going to let him take over. And hang on to your hats, people. And you might want to have a pencil and paper handy.
Thanks, Gary. Here we go again, once again, with a new JFK show. Tonight, we're going to focus a little bit on the Zapruder film. And Jim Fetzer has published two volumes on this, the Great Zapruder Film Hoax, and a couple of chapters in Assassination Science. And tonight we're going to focus a little bit more specifically on the blink rate of the front red lights, which were on each side of the grill of the JFK limousine. And both of these lights had a specific timing. What we've done here tonight is use other films as a frame of reference, so that we could pinpoint exactly the time frame of the blink, the actual blink of these lights. Okay. Now, in doing the math here of what we're going to talk about tonight, the official version of the frame rate of the Zapruder film is 18.3 frames per second. Okay, and now this works out to the time for each frame to be projected to be 0.0546 seconds. Now that's not very much time. Okay, and that is based on 18.3 frames per second. All right. Now, if this were to be 24 frames per second, it would have been even less time for each frame, which would have brought it down to 0.041. Now, this is the framework that we're laying so that we can establish how many frames are going to be projected for each blink of each red light. And we have a right and a left light on the limo. Okay, now calculating the blink rate cycle, which means from when one red light goes on the left and then it cycles to the right and then it goes back to the left. Okay, now we've used two films that show the limo coming down Main Street and turning onto Houston. Okay, the first one is the Hughes film. And the second one is the Marie Muchmore film. Okay. Now, I have a special program that calculates and where you're able to plot exactly how long each blink consumes as far as time is concerned. Okay. And by using this program, I was able to establish that the cycle, for example, speaking of the left or the right, either one, the left blink light flashes approximately every 1.25 seconds. Now, these are very specific times on both of these because if you examine, and we're going to show these now momentarily here for our audience, when you examine both of these films, you can see the exact, and this is very exact, the exact timing of the blink rate on both of these. The right and the left light. And this is extremely important because Roy Schaefer, one of the pioneers in this research, published, and this was also published in the two books that I just mentioned, a chart of the blink rate. And he used an old Zapruder film. What I've used here in revisiting this research has been the John Costella film, which is a lot clearer, and we're able to discern the images a lot better once we enlarge them, and we're going to also show some of these here tonight. Okay, now these blink lights, they flash approximately every 0.35 seconds. Okay, and the duration of the blink is approximately 0.5 seconds, about half a second. Okay, again the transition from one to the other is about 0.35, about one third of a second, and the duration of the blink is about half a second. Okay, can you go on to the next slide, please? Chance. Lou. Next slide.
Just to make a point about Roy Schaefer's work, Larry.
Yes.
His chart appeared in a chapter co-authored with Mike Pinscher Fascination Science in 1998. Now, all three volumes have work on the Zapruder film, but Roy's is only in that book. Then Murder in Dealey Plaza 2000, there's a brilliant chapter by David Mantic, an overview about the film. And then, of course, in 2003, the great Zapruder film hoax, which has six contributors, but not including Roy Schaefer. So Roy's work actually just appears in the first, in the Assassination Science, 1998.
Thank you, Jim. He's provided me with his blink chart, and all I've done is follow his research and try to apply it to the Costella images, which once you see and are able to visualize that these are much clearer images, then it takes on an entire new dimension here as far as I'm concerned. Now, at 0.35 second intervals per blink and 0.53 second duration of the blink, we can calculate the frames per second of the Zapruder film. And more importantly, we can pinpoint where it has been edited by the removal of frames. Okay. Now, since each frame should project for, and this was our first calculation here at the beginning, 0.0546, and that's using the 18.3 frames per second parameter that we mentioned. The duration of the blink then should be simple division, 0.53 over the first calculation, then it should come out to about almost 10 frames per second, 9.7 frames. per second of the Zapruder film. In other words, each blink should continue on in the film for almost 10 frames. Now, anybody who's seen the Zapruder film can tell you right away that you never see a blink there that that goes on for 10 frames. But we're going to show the audience here, and we're going to go on a frame-by-frame basis real quickly here.
I just point out, Larry, that while the point you're making is sufficient to show frames every move, it's not necessary because they could have excised a whole lot of frames and yet preserved the continuity of the frame rate between the last frame they left and the first frame they continued to use. So it's sufficient, but it's not necessary.
Yeah, the only problem with that is that there would have been a visible reaction within the people in the background of of some of these frames. That's why I believe that at the beginning there's some frame removal, but not as much as we see later on. And we'll cover this as we go because it's
Larry, when they turn from Houston on town, there's actually a huge jump to the.
That's right.
And I estimate at least 100 frames were excised.
Absolutely.
Okay, go for it.
Yeah. So any sequence of frames, and this goes exactly follows exactly what you just mentioned, Jim. Any sequence of frames where the blink is less would indicate that frames have been removed. Okay.
Yeah, go for it, Larry.
What about the transition time? Okay, the transition would be the time. Would be the transition of 0.35 plus the duration, which would give 0.88 seconds. This is the amount of time in between, and in the cycle, total cycle, the blink. What I'm talking about here is that the timing where there are none of the two lights are on, and this would be calculated as about almost 7 frames per second. And we're going to see some of these frames that you're going to see that none of the two lights are on. Okay, and it's important because sometimes there's only 2 frames where you don't see any of the 2 lights on. Okay, so that's very interesting. Once I start, working within these parameters, how much time, the blink lasted per frames, et cetera, So if we go on to the next slide, Jim.
What you're saying, Larry, is when you apply this criterion to determine the excision of frames, there's been a massive amount of editing that has never been explicitly discussed before.
We're going to look at that right now. Okay, and now this first frame is from the Hughes, okay, and we can just go on quickly here. As you can see at the bottom, it says...
You have to tell Chance when to advance.
Yeah, you can go on, and what we're doing here is just presenting the left blink light here. And Chance, you can go on to the next one.
Go to 4.
And there's the next, and only 1.25 seconds have gone by here. Now go on to the next.
Yeah, go to 5.
Okay, and there again is the left. Now these three frames, the difference in timing is only 1.25 seconds, give or take maybe a little bit. But by and large, that's the time that it takes for the cycle, for the left light to go on and then to the next cycle, about 1.25 seconds. Now, go ahead to the next one.
7.
Yeah. Now, when we apply this to the Hue, to the Much More film, we find almost the exact same relationship. And these are two different people that were recording from two different positions. Okay, this is the turn from Main on to Elm, and we have the left light is on. Go ahead, next one. Okay, and here's the next cycle. Okay, and if at the bottom you can see 1.246 seconds have gone by between one and the other. And go on to the next one. And there's another cycle. Okay, so we've had three different cycles here on the left blink light. And now we're going to run those two films. Okay, we're going to run them a couple of times so our audience can see exactly what we're talking about once they see both the blink lights in action here. Go ahead, Chance. Okay, what we're seeing now is a compilation of both the Hughes and the Much More films. Okay, and it's running a couple of times, and you can see the limo, and you can see blink lights and the rhythm. I think this is very important, the rhythm back and forth and how they are very predictable. Okay. And by plotting these out with a computer program, we can time the exact amount of time that one takes between one and the other, and how long it takes for the one blink light to stay, and then the transition between one and the other. Once we're done, we can go on to the next slide. Okay. And our next slide, Chance, is going to show the time of that left light is going to be on. Okay. At the bottom, we have 0.818 seconds. Okay. And then the next
11.
The next slide, yeah. Okay. 1.35. So this came out to about 0.53 seconds. About a little bit, about give or take about half a second, is the amount of time that that blink light is running, is on. Okay. Now, go on to the next. Now, we're going to just run some of these frames here, frame by frame, and these are close-ups, actual close-ups of the Costello film, okay? Now, starting from Z133, and as Jim mentioned, up to 132, we don't see the limo, and it jumps in right at frame 133, and this is exactly what Jim was just talking about, that possibly up to maybe even 100 frames were extricated, you know, up until this point. And, you know, God knows what happened there on Elm Street at the turn of Houston, because as we all know, Zapruder even mentioned and said that he started filming as the limo made the turn from Houston onto Elm Street, I'm sorry, and we don't see that in the Zapruder frame.
And it filmed continuously until it disappeared under the triple underpass.
That's correct. So this first frame shows the blink light on the right, okay?
Rich Della Rosa was talking about how the when the limo made that turn from Houston onto Elm, the driver, the wheels of the limo went up on the sidewalk
on
there.
The curb, yeah, Roy Trulli. Yeah. He almost got run over by Greer. Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, he seems to have mistaken the little road that runs right in front of the book depository for Elm Street, and he swung out way too wide, and then they had to recover, and he did a very poor job of it. I think he didn't want the public to see how sloppy the Secret Service was in navigating this turn.
They had to yank those frames out.
Or perhaps he was lining it up so that the shot from the Daltex would have been, you know, a straight shot, you know, and avoid the policemen, the motorcycle cops.
Yeah, right, there are multiple considerations here. I agree. Go.
Yeah, next frame. This is 134 coming up. And this is blurry here. And some of these frames where it shows obvious removal, the next frame seemed to have been blurred on purpose, you know, as here's the frame 135.
I think that's a very important point, Larry, that when they did excision, so you can't get a close comparison and tell what had happened, they blurred the frames deliberately so it would obfuscate what had happened.
That's right. When you start this micro study, you know, you realize that that's a very, very distinct possibility. Okay, now, this, I don't know how you guys see this, but I don't know if it's the right. I'm a little, you guys can give an opinion here. What you see here, if it's the right or the left. They both look the same here to me, but.
Yeah, but Jim DiEugenio doesn't think the film was altered that much, though.
That much. Okay, we can go on to the next one, the 136.
So you're saying that it appears that they're both on at the same time?
Well, no,
they're
yeah,
just fuzzy. They're real fuzzy. Yeah, they're real fuzzy, it too.
Could be
yeah.
caught in transition here. It's also a possibility. Now, go on to the next one, 137. So you can see a big difference here coming up. Okay, now it's obvious that it's the right one that's on, okay? And if we can go straight on, go right through these. Next one, 138 is to the left, 139 left, 40 left. Go ahead. 141 left. 142 left. 143 left. 144, you jumped, okay, I just wanted you to stop right there, 146. Now, this seems to be the only...
He's on 147, he's on 146.
Yeah, right, yeah, 146, I want to stop here. This seems to be the only sequence where there seems to have been, it seems to adhere to the 10-frame sequence as per the Hughes and the Muchmore films. It seems to be, of all the Zapruder film, this seems to be the only area, the only sequence of frames that seems to have been untouched, remarkably. So as we can see, we just saw 10 frames in a row, and they're all on the left blink light. I think this is very important because we don't see the same pattern for the rest of the film. Okay, and as we've seen from 137 to 146, they're all on the left side, the left blink light. Okay, now from here on in, you're going to see that they're all over the place, especially after the limo comes from behind the Stemmons Freeway sign. And if Chance can run that first MP4 that we had lined up that shows 133 to 182, Chance. We have a special MP4 for that. It's on?
I was going to say, well, Chance is looking for that. It'd be nice to see maybe in some other week if you can line it up. To me, it looks like the front end of this limo is a lot fuzzier than the rest of of what's going on.
Well, it might have to do with the zooming in. Okay, but basically this is what comes out of the Costello Zapruder film. It's a lot better than anything else that's out there, that's for sure. Yeah, that's the one. Okay, it's playing. Okay, yeah. The reason...
Don, I think we got your background noise again.
Okay. Now, that's the sequence with the close-up of where we have zoomed in on frames 133 to 182, which is right before the limo disappears behind the Stemmons Freeway sign. Okay. Now, we can go on to the next slide here, Chance. 147. Now, here... On 147, how you guys see this one, but it seems like it's in the interval between one and the, both the blink lights. The next one. 148, the same thing. Yeah, the same thing here. 149. Now 149, was on the left, and then 150, yeah, go back to 149. Right. Okay. You see the difference there? Now, 151. Next. Okay. 52. 53. Here's where the glare of the sun starts to hit the grill, and it makes it a little bit difficult here. 54. Now, here's a really good example that shows that none of the lights are on, okay? And we get a couple of frames here, 155, 154, I believe, and 155. Yeah, see? None of the blink lights are visible here at all. None of them, period. And we should have seen more of this in the Zapruder film, but we don't. Okay, so that in itself shows that there's something very funny going on here. Go ahead. That's 156, right? Here it seems to be on the left. 159, right? 160. Sixty-five, left. 66. 68. We're almost done here. That's 170. Okay. Now this just gives a sample here of how these blink lights, you know, are totally inconsistent here. When you compare those blink lights to the much more in the Hughes film, there's just no rhythm here at all whatsoever. Now I just want to real quickly go through a couple of frames here. Next slide, 131. Right, 131 and 132. These two frames, now, don't forget that we just, at the beginning of the show, we established that there's supposed to be 0.0564 difference between frames as far as time, seconds, okay? Now, within that time frame, any movement, any visible movement that you see of people, it's going to be pretty obvious that frames have been removed because it's physically impossible to move that fast. Okay, now if you look at these two frames, just if you focus on any group of people or any one person in this scene here, you'll see that, you know, they're moving. They're not static. They're not in the same position. And I wanted to focus on the man with the hard hat here, because this is a very good example. Now, it just doesn't have to be just him. Just look at any of the other people, you know, between these two frames. And again, 132 is blurred in comparison to 131, all right, which we mentioned earlier. Now, if you go on to the next slide, number 52, okay. Okay, now, just look between when we zoom in on the hard hat man, you know, based on 18.3 frames per second, he's moved his head about 90 degrees left in only 0.054 seconds. Now, if this was if this were based on 24 frames per second, he would have moved in even less time, 0.041 seconds. Now, this is something that is extremely important, because we're seeing, you know, within two frames, that there is a lot of movement, much more movement than is physically possible, you know, for any human being. Okay, you can now, if you can run that MP4 here, hard hat MP4, and I have a little MP4 here that with an overlay that shows exactly what I'm talking about. Are you there, Chance? Hard hat man. Okay, it'll play a couple of times. Okay, so now we're let me get okay now. Now, the last slide that I wanted to show is Charles Brehm and his son Joe. Okay. Now, the frame that we're referring to is frame 280 and 283. This is another Roy Schaefer discovery here. Okay. Frames 280 and 283. If you look closely at these two frames, you'll see that it's physically impossible for Joey Brehm to come out from behind his father in only three frames. So we're talking about, like I said, 0.054 frames, seconds per frame. Okay, that is extremely fast. It's totally impossible for that kid to have moved, you know, from being behind his father to being beside him. Okay, and not only that, you can see the rhythm of Charles Bram's clapping, you know, it's totally out of sync. All right. And so this is another example that and I have many, okay, and I'm gonna show one last one here, and it has to do with Malcolm Summers. Okay, and Malcolm Summers is the gentleman that we see much later in frames 240 something, where he's diving to his right. Okay, but the speed with which he does this in only 11 frames is just astounding. The man totally dives to his right, and then he hops back into a squatting position in 11 frames, which again is totally impossible. Can you play that that clip there, Malcolm Summers? Okay, it's gonna play a couple of times here, so. Okay, so that basically is what I wanted to show our audience tonight, and I didn't want to go on to the portion of the Zapruder film going past the Stemmons freeway sign, because it's just that portion we believe has been reshot with an optical printer, with the background being totally out of sync in the size of the people in the background with the people in the limo. And one thing about that Malcolm Summers clip, it also coincides with the time that we believe the motorcycle cops, where Shaney and Hargis and Jackson did all those actions that they spoke about in our series of the JFK Horsemen. And it shows that that's a very, very possible smoking gun, where those films were also extricated, which show the actions of Hargis running, for example, running in front of the Queen Mary on his way up to the grassy knoll, and the Secret Service men dismounting and running past the limo with their guns drawn. That's a very high possibility that could have been one of the areas where that was removed from the film.
Now, in relation to your hard hat example, Noel Twyman, already in Bloody Treason, 1997, established that William Greer is looking back at JFK and then turns mm-hmm. forward too fast to be humanly possible. Actually, he hired a tennis player to determine how fast he could turn his head and discovered that Greer turns his head twice as fast as is humanly possible. Which doesn't sound like much initially until you realize that turns a 4-minute mile into a 2-minute mile. You're talking about something that no person could do and therefore represents, again, a whole lot of excision of frames.
That's right. And also, I believe it was Jack White who discovered that flatbed or pickup truck there in the background, which from I believe a Cancellare photograph shows that the pickup truck has people inside or material, but in the Zapruder film, it's been totally flattened out where there's nothing back there. Okay, so that those are just examples of tampering that we know are provable with the Zapruder film.
Don, I know you want to get in on this.
Yeah, I was going to say that with Greer, with the head movement back and forth so quick, that's where a lot of this business where people think, oh, Greer shot Kennedy. That's where all that crap comes from, is because it looks like Greer is up to something the way his head is going back and forth, but it's
actually, it's much more elaborate than that, Don. It's because it looks as though he's turned and has a revolver in his left hand.
Yes.
It appears to be a reflection off of the head of Killerman, but William Cooper, using a very blurry version, advanced that hypothesis. And in Cooper's film, because it's so blurry, you can't tell the difference. The point I'd make is that if Greer had shot Jack, since Greer was to his left front, his brains would have been blown out to the right rear. Instead, they're blown out
That's
to
right.
the left. Rear,
yeah, exactly. Yeah, there's no other evidence. And really, it's really like what the path Larry is going down is undoubtedly correct, where frames have been removed from the film And that's why Greer's movements are so otherworldly.
Sure, of course.
Yeah. No, also, Larry,
have you reflected on how many frames you suspect this your method has revealed to have been removed? And do you believe that it does substantiate the hypothesis that the film was actually shot at 24 frames per second, not 18.3?
Oh yeah, it does, and it confirms that many frames have been removed, and Douglas Horn has also mentioned that the abrupt movement of JFK was augmented because of the extrication of the frames around Zapruder 313.
And right. I talk about that extensively, many places. Where after the limo stop, he was hit twice in the back of the head from the Dal taxi, flopped forward. Jackie eased him back up, was looking him right in the face when he was hit in the right temple by that frangible or exploding bullet fired from the intersection of the triple underpass and the picket fence, and he slumped to the left. So that it was only when they merged the two together that the only residue you had was from 312 to 313, and then the jerky left into the rear is because they excised so many other frames.
Yes, and I also wanted to mention that the first researcher to advance the notion of Greer shooting JFK was actually Fred Newcomb, and then Roy also did research on that. And but it's like you said, Jim. You know, the debris would have gone in the direction of Shaney. And even though Shaney was sprayed, but he wasn't hit in the same manner that Hargis was. And,
right.
So that's a big difference there.
Right.
It's very strange. Will, I was just going to say it's very strange because Will Cooper seemed to have done a lot of good work, but then all of a sudden he just, out of the blue, started to push the limo driver doing it.
Look, I know perfectly good people today who still believe that Greer shot JFK.
Yeah, I think it's because of these missing frames that's why it's getting traction with the public. Is they're kind of confused by what's going on there, I think.
What happens after the Stemmons Freeway sign is a totally different ball game. You have to divide
it's completely retimed the film.
You have to divide this from before and after the Stemmons Freeway sign. That's my take on this. Okay, because after the Stemmons Freeway sign, for example, and this is something that we've been working on continuously now, is that frame 255 should have shown Officer Shaney as he is shown in the Alton 6 photograph. Okay, he's within arm's distance. He can touch JFK. And he's in a position where he is above the door line of the limo, and he should be visible in the Zapruder film in several frames. However, he is not. All right? And this is something that, for example, this is the reason why this past November in Dallas, I went and recreated the Zapruder film from the same pedestal, and I realized that even cars, as they were passing by side by side, sort of generally in the same perspective, you know, and orientation, but the limo and Officer Shaney should have been, and those cars are perfectly visible. Okay, so
don't you think the way that the limousine recedes beneath the center of the frame of reference suggests it may have been shot from a tripod in the pergola rather than
head? Also a possibility.
Zapruder would have been centering it on the limousine. I mean, he would never have allowed the limousine to almost disappear.
It's a possibility. Well, you know, that's why it's important to establish that everything that happens post Stemmons Freeway sign, that's a totally different ballgame as far as I'm concerned, because that is the most important sequence, and that's where they had to do, you know, all their magic there.
Yeah, I think Jim's really onto something there with the tripod business. I don't think the Zapruder film, any of it was shot by Zapruder.
Well, Jack found that image that shows Sitzman, you know, standing in front of him, okay, from the other side of, from Commerce, over from the other side on Commerce, okay?
Well, what Jack found was a whole multiplicity of inconsistent images that strongly suggest that they were positioning him now retrospectively rather than that he had been an authentic presence.
Yeah, yeah. Well, if they were going
they needed someone to whom they would attribute the source of the film.
Right.
They may very well have actually been using the tripod in the center of the pergola.
That's right.
I mean, there's no reason why an actual human being who's following the limousine would ever have let it get so far out of the center of the frame.
That's another point where you see exactly, especially the lower part where it disappears all, completely, very conveniently, I might say. Okay, so
it's ridiculous to think a human being who's filming the President of the United States would allow that to happen to get him out of the center of the frame.
Right. And we've spoken, many times about the motorcycle policemen and their non-reactions to gunfire, because they mentioned many times in testimony where they said that they looked around over both their shoulders, but you look at the Zapruder film and they're not looking anywhere. They're looking straight ahead. In fact, maybe over towards the president, but they're never looking over their shoulders in response to gunfire because they couldn't hear any gunfire. So, with the motorcycle, sound of the motorcycle.
If we go back to your frame, Z131, Chances, the fourth from the end, if you could go back to that momentarily.
Yeah. That's a classic right there, because when you compare one to the other, I mean, it's pretty obvious that stuff has been removed between one and the other,
Well, what many commentators have noticed is that even when the president's here, this row of bystanders does not cheer and wave the way everyone else does everywhere else on the motorcade, leading to the inference that they replaced the foreground. And as you observe, it was using these sophisticated techniques of optical printing and special effects with footage that had been shot when the pilot car passed, and the people weren't animated because it was only the pilot car, not Jack and Jackie, but there was something there going on in the foreground they needed to conceal. So they used the footage that had been shot earlier to create a new foreground here of these relatively motionless spectators.
Yeah. And the crescendo of the noise was from what the witnesses have stated, that it was very obvious that once the actual motorcade, the actual limo, started to come down Houston and turn on Elm Street, it was very loud, and with the sirens and everything, and the people clapping and yelling and, screaming, so.
And of course, the idea that the presidential limousine would be out first in the motorcade is a manifest absurdity. It should have been in the middle. This is one of more than 15 indications we have of Secret Service complicity in setting him up for the hit. It was going to be too confusing if he was in the middle after the mayor, after the vice president, after the flatbed truck carrying the reporters and their camera crews to cover this important event. So they simply obviated all the standard procedures and put him out front to make it easier for the snipers to target the victim.
Amazing.
My big question is, if you're the perps, why even release this film to the public, even altering it? What?
Because they never believed the public would accept the story they were going to spin if they didn't have visual proof thereof. Look, what if Jack had been killed in the midnight at the White House? He just wakes up dead. No one in the world would doubt it had been a conspiracy. They had to do it in public in a way that they could control, but that could be used to convince the public that it had been done by, in this case, a lone demented assassin. And for that, they had to control the body. They had to control the film. They had agents at all the film processing centers in Dallas for 2 weeks after the assassination, taking
up
films that were related to Dealey Brothers.
Nobody saw that movie, though, until the Clay Shaw trial in 1969.
I was going to say that. They did not intend
But that was because it didn't come out as well as they had hoped, but they needed to have it. Claim they'd seen it, and then if ever it were necessary to bring it out, and yes, you're right, when it was brought out, the flaws began to be conspicuous. But remember, everyone was furious with Dan Razor because he said Jack had slumped forward. Well, Jack had slumped forward, but then Jack eased him back up, and he's shot again, and he slumps to the left. So
Razor was
savage. Rather was savage for not describing the violent back and to the left, which Rather didn't report because Rather never saw it.
There was considerable violence.
Violence. Forward. Yep. Considerable violence. He went forward, yeah.
Yeah, looks like they had a lot of magic to take out, but getting the lights to line up was a physical impossibility.
So I think there were considerations that just didn't cross their mind. I actually believe the blink rate is one of those that they never considered. They never thought anyone would notice. And it was part of the genius of Roy Schaefer to realize that there was this internal clock to the timing of events going on there because of the blink rate. So that, while Roy, in my opinion, has not been completely successful in articulating his case and in proving it without a lot of flaws and shortcomings, he's had terrific insights about some of these points. And I think you're doing a nice job of vindicating Roy's initial sense about the importance of the blink rate, Larry.
So you don't believe?
And I think there's still a lot.
Go ahead, Larry.
No, and I think there's still a lot of work to be done on this, Jim, because, once we have been able to calibrate what the blink rate should be using films that are, comparable, because they show the limo coming down, within a few yards.
Suppose we just restricted our focus of evidence about the alteration of the film, which is super abundant and so much of which we presented, including the JFK horseman and all that, to what you presented. It still makes the Jim DiEugenio or the Robert Groden or the Josiah Thompson position that the film is authentic and unaltered ridiculous.
I know.
Ridiculous. Just a small amount of evidence produced here about the blink rate that Roy Schaefer, for God's sake, observed years and years ago, first published in Assassination Science 1998, already refutes the contention that the film is authentic.
Yeah, and Roy has a lot of other points, very interesting points about the authenticity of the film. For example, the dye markings on the side between the sprocket holes, which are totally inconsistent with what is seen today in the film, and those are points that somebody that has had a lot of experience handling this type of material, because don't forget that 8mm is archaic. We don't even see that anymore. We don't even know what it looks like anymore. And somebody like Roy Schaefer, who has the experience and who's handled that, those type of people, are not going to be around, that much longer.
That's right. Roy had professional training in processing and dealing with films and photographs like these we're discussing here today. You're absolutely right.
That's right. And pretty soon, we're not even going to have, somebody who can come out and say, hey, this film should have been like this or like that, and however it is not, and that's my point about how important Roy Schaefer's contributions have been.
Yeah.
But wait a minute. Black Cop Radio said last week that they're going to be looking at possible Z film alteration in the future.
Gee, so, you're kidding me. In 2016, they announced they're going to be looking at it in the future?
Yes.
This is ludicrous. This is ridiculous. This makes them look like blooming idiots.
Well, now that I think back on it, I do recall reading in the Warren Report where they did call the Zapruder film the time clock of the assassination.
Right, absolutely.
Good point.
Yeah, maybe that was the original intent, was, hey, we can we'll use this as our version of the assassination.
Well, look, Don, you go through the Warren Commission and they cite the specific frames, they cite the specific timing, the angles, it's all there in the Warren Report. They needed it to build their case for a three-shot scenario.
Well, first of all,
Josiah Thompson, may I remind you, has said that the Zapruder film is the closest thing we have to the absolute truth about the assassination of JFK.
Whoops.
the frames that the Warren Commission published, let's not forget, were all black and white, all blurry,
out of order.
Crap, you know, in comparison, Life magazine was the first publication to start publishing some of the frames, you know, only some of the frames, 31
frames. Yes, yes.
In the November 29th issue, 1963. But once they had cleaned it all up, you know, and then let's not forget that when it was first published, Hoover even admitted that frames 313 and 314 had been reversed. Okay.
To make David Lifton had his girlfriend write to Hoover and was just dumbfounded when he wrote back and confirmed that indeed in the Warren Commission supporting volumes they had it.
So, you know, all of these interesting tidbits about the Zapruder film, that it's never going to go out of style, you know, for researchers to be arguing about it. But I think that now that this is a blink rate, you know, is something that really needs to be researched further. And especially now that we can calibrate the blink rate with those two films.
Well, I think those who are interested in this aspect should go back to Assassination Science and read the chapter by Schaefer and Mike Pincher. It's very interesting to see this pioneering work that you're refining here using a better quality version of the film provided by Costella.
Yeah.
Which I refer as the Costella combined cut, because he's restored the missing frames. He's removed aspect ratio and pincushion distortion and the clarity of the film. It's by far the best available. Even the MPI, which is largely regarded as the gold standard, is grossly inferior. It has many frames in the wrong order. It has frames that are missing. The Costella film is decidedly the place to go, and you can find it at assassinationscience.com. Just scroll down to the new Zapruder film, meaning the new rendering of the film by removing pincushion and aspect ratio distortion, restoring the missing frames and all that. It's really a brilliant piece of work. I'm so glad to see you're taking advantage of it, Larry.
And Jim, and don't forget, no copyright restrictions. I think that's
right. Important. That's right. This is not a version of the film over which the Sixth Floor Museum exercises control at all.
Yeah,
this is
yeah.
a very good thing.
I don't know. If you've been checking with Robert on, you've been checking with Robert Grodin on all this stuff.
Well, don't forget, Gary, that the first thing that he said on Friday night at Judy Vera Baker's conference this past November were two things, that the Zapruder film was authentic and that the man in the door was Billy Lovelady.
The first speaker, the first thing, 10 minutes apiece. And
you see, I do not understand how Judith Baker, who knows better, can continue to be supportive of Robert Grodin, because he's been undermining her at every step, even with the HSCA. He was telling them on the basis of an argument that Judith has refuted that the man in the doorway was Billy Lovelady, when in fact it was Lee Oswald, and where Judith cemented Lee in the doorway with her study that completely reversed the claims made by Robert Grodin. How she could continue to tolerate his presence is simply beyond me.
Well, so what do we do about that?
No, it's going to change. It's going to change. Trust me. It's going to change, Jim. It's not going to be like that next year.
Robert Grodin is kind of the Richard Gage of JFK.
Yeah. Well, looks like we just got a couple of minutes left. Y'all want to
No, we don't have a couple of minutes, Gary. We have less than that. Everyone, you want to invite everyone to give their parting words.
Yeah. Go ahead, Larry.
No, I'm done. You guys go ahead.
Don?
Yeah, I just want to say we've got more, you know, more stuff on the way coming up, in future shows about, Israeli nukes and, JFK.
I've got some more work coming up in the future about, I've really been having a lot of requests of people wanting to know, what does it mean today? The results of the assassination, how do we look at today as a result of that? And I've got some new work on that. And, Dr. Fetcher, close us out.
Oh, Gary, I think that's a terrific idea, yes. What happened to JFK and why it matters today was a two-plus-hour presentation I gave at the University of Wisconsin-Madison in 2011. Everyone can find it there online today. That might be a good place to start. I'm glad we're going to return to that theme. Gary, close us out.
All right. Chance George, in the engineer's chair, once again, we thank you very much. This is JFK Show number 89. And Don, please be on the lookout for this new Z film operation over there at Black Ops Radio, okay? Give us a heads up whenever they're talking about it. We'll see you next week.